Okay, so I'm going to start.
I sent out the message, but I'm here for a little while.
I have to admit that it's not a good position to be in to talk about giving talks, because inevitably anything I say is going to fall short of the principles I enunciate. So I'm not going to talk about talks. I'm going to enlist your help. And even though you're theorists, I'm going to ask you to be experimentalists or at least observers. And we've all been to talks. We all know what is a good talk and what's a bad talk. So instead of my telling you what the principles are, we're going to fill out these forms. And I think you can do it just as well as I can. It's sometimes just useful to have them pointing out to you. So I have topics. I have preparation and what goes into the thinking beforehand and the planning of exactly what you're going to put into your talk, the delivery, the view graphs, the visuals that you might have, and then the Q&A, the question and answer sessions, either during or after your talk. So I think that the delivery part is an easier thing to get going on. We all probably all have a little bit more idea about what good and bad delivery. So let's start there. And what are some of the things that you should or should not do in giving your talk, or things that have really driven you crazy when you listen to a talk?
An adequate introduction.
An adequate introduction, okay. Actually, I'm going to...
Are these talks for what audience? Are they for general talks?
Okay,
for specialized audience?
I'm not talking... I think we're not talking about specialized audience. Mm-hmm. Talking about either, say, a university colloquium, or... And that's the most technical, or a public lecture. Mm-hmm. And I think they both share the same things. I think there's some additional things you have to do for the public that you don't necessarily have to do for a colloquium. But in either case, it's a more general audience and I think a little bit more formal setting. Okay, so you...
Yeah, but you always have to tell people why they should be listening to you at all, why they should be interested in anything you're about to say.
Right, I'm going to put this... maybe preparation isn't a good way to say it, but this is what goes into your talk.
You have content up there.
Well, this is the content. Okay. Okay, maybe that's a better word. Preparing the content. So adequate introduction to your material. And specifically what way? I mean, what is a good way to start? What are some of the things you want to do, Sarah? Okay, engage them and motivate them, right? Sometimes with a question, sometimes with a neat visual or anecdote or whatever, yeah. Okay,
Well, there are different ways of setting the context. You can put it in historical context.
Mm-hmm.
So you can put it in the context of some important question that everybody knows about.
Mm-hmm.
And outline. There's different ways of doing that, but it's important to be able to set the context and pose the particular question you want to hear.
Yeah, I think especially for the general audience, the historical or cultural. Okay.
Even for colloquium. Often talking non-specialists, why should they be interested in this particular?
That's true. I think a lot of times people who speak for a colloquium forget that that's a huge opportunity to recruit graduate students. One of my fellow classmates from Stanford gave a colloquium once that I thought everyone in the that had everyone in the audience wanted to sign up for low temperature physics because he just made it so interesting and he. And he was so full of excitement. Okay, anything else? Joe, what was the thing that you thought about your own delivery the other night? By the way, Joe gave a super colloquium to a public group the other night. And then he came back and viewed himself and was critical.
Well, I took criticism One, you know, when I give a talk, especially to a public audience, by the end of the hour, I am so wired, exhausted. And is there, I mean, I don't think everybody does that. I don't know what it is. I wish I didn't get quite so. I mean, is there any other tricks to avoid? I mean, I
What about the anybody else have that? Does anyone else have that experience?
I think only when you give a good talk, because it means you've been involved heavily in it.
I think it's a good thing.
It's different than the talks you give in other circumstances.
Well, I mean, I think there are people who can give a talk and not feel dead after it, you know, feel kind of calm about it.
Maybe the audience is the same way in that.
I think it is true. I think your adrenaline really flows. Yeah, I think it's I feel that way. I feel my adrenaline flows when I give a talk. If I try to practice it, and one thing you're supposed to do is practice in front of friends, and I get up and I sit my poor husband down. And I try to give this talk, and it's so fake. I can't give a good talk. It's so fakey. And then I get up in front of an audience, and then I'm performing. I just feel a huge difference in myself. And books that I was reading say, not only do you have that adrenaline, but you also end up talking faster than normal. So you have to make an effort to speak slowly.
The other thing I noticed when I listened to that, maybe this is what you're referring to, appalled by how often I said, You know, this is especially at the beginning of my talk. I had not, I don't practice out loud, but I run it through my own mind probably 20 times. It's somehow when I'm standing up in front of people trying to say those same words, it's three words and a lot of three, four words and a lot of I think actually I should probably need to really practice out loud.
Mm-hmm.
I've never done that for a long time.
But on the other hand, I told Joe that I didn't notice that in his talk after.
I didn't notice it.
That's right. Okay. So maybe it's just the first
thing. You know, your excitement came through. You were so excited that it was a bit difficult to get it all out.
I think the audience, that you appear human, that's better than an automaton.
Yeah. I was also listening to myself, and I didn't feel like the just the presentation yesterday was too much and stuff. I mean, maybe that's just my style. There were a couple of people sleeping during it.
Well,
it was very messy.
Well, I don't think, what?
There's two different styles, really. There's one that takes you along the story, which you did. The humor was good, the anecdotes were good, the ominous part of enthusiasm. And there's another style which is very polished. You feel that you're listening to performance, it's very engaging and interesting. But they're very different styles of talk, and they probably take different amounts of energy out of you.
Mm-hmm.
If you gave the same talk again to a similar audience, you probably would,
But anyway, because of you mentioned the I'm just putting down, beware of annoying habits that you might have. So, maybe it's saying, maybe it's like always scratching your head, or maybe it's like walking too much, whatever. But
David walks too much. He doesn't walk. These things probably don't bother the audience as
But facing the audience occasionally probably a good idea.
And correlator that's really important and is make eye contact. See, Joe, you wouldn't even know that they were falling asleep if you hadn't been trying to make eye contact. What eyes?
Well, there's voice too. You should project. You should enunciate.
Okay. And I would say related to that would be speak slowly.
Yeah.
And again, remember the tendency to speak fast when you're in front of a crowd. That's just a known fact, apparently. And especially in a program like this, I'm more aware of it because we have so many people here for whom English is not the first language. And I'm always amazed how someone, say, a German in the audience listening to, say, a Japanese speak English, you know, it's not a native language for either one, and they're trying to connect through several layers of accents. So I think speaking slowly is especially important to help that out. So it must be 1:15, 2:15. Chris, we learned earlier that people from Denmark don't come until 15 after this.
Well, in Denmark, you know, it's sort of like dinner invitation goes the other way around. And then the Danes come on time and Americans come 15 minutes later.
Oh.
So this is this reciprocity
agreement. Yeah. Yeah. Sarah?
Under content, I'd say I think you really need to know your audience. You need to know how to, what level that they're asked, because you can either be a very broad audience and you have to be able to include a range of background, or it could be a very focused audience and you don't want to undercut or overcut.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point, right?
In the second one, projection, enunciation, I don't know, their animation is a different thing, but. Droning is.
Okay. And there's probably, so you mentioned animation, there's probably midway point between pacing and making your audience nervous and standing there like this. Yeah.
No, I was thinking of vocal rather than physical.
Yeah.
You know, I've learned some things from my friends in the theater about the Red Room.
Yes.
Talk to them and find out what they do. I do a little bit of it myself. For instance, warm up your voice anymore. A little more. My friend John used to go out in the garden and go, no, blah, 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 blah. What were you doing? No, that was definitely.
Well, there is a certain amount of truth to that, because Brian Green gave one of the best lectures downtown for the Institute we've heard in a long time, and he admits to great immersion in theater and how you animate a talk.
Yeah.
And I don't think he comes across as an actor, but it's clear that he understands the importance of projection, animation, everything else with his voice.
Mm-hmm. What about your dress in terms of what you wear? Any thoughts about that? Well, I think the point is not so much that you have to get dressed up, but I think whatever you wear needs to be comfortable and probably fairly simple, while still being appropriate, because if it's too fancy and you're fidgeting with it, or that's a drawback, or if there's just some bright pattern that's going to distract the audience, you might just get, you know, you don't want it to be an issue.
John Conway doesn't take that point of view. I think John Conway in Princeton, whenever he gives a talk, he makes a point of wearing a big bright T-shirt.
Oh, really? So maybe it doesn't have to be simple dress, huh?
Yeah, I guess I would enjoy if they dress outrageous.
Okay.
Probably depends who you are.
Okay. Any?
One little thing. Learn how to use a microphone if one is actually using one.
Are you thinking of David again?
No, he's not the worst example. But if you're holding a mic, you don't pull it too close, don't talk to the side of it. There's a few little things like that. Mm-hmm. Just don't learn unless
they're... Well, that probably goes for other equipment too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Among the equipment, I've made my notes myself, but among the equipment that sometimes needs practice is the laser pointer, which people tend to let flicker all over the place. It's hard to control it anyway. I sometimes think the old-fashioned wooden pointer works pretty well.
Especially if one's a little nervous, the laser pointer.
And you're trying to show this little teeny star on a background of a whole bunch, and it's like, which one?
I think you have to know the room as well, not just the equipment. I mean, sometimes it's a surprise to come into a room and not to help to see it first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good point. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to give a big title, I always want to go just walk around the room for 5 minutes first.
Mm-hmm. Well, that helps. I think if you're the speaker, I think it helps you to be less nervous. If you get there early enough, know the room, so it's not all too unfamiliar. And if you can, like you say, get there and give a little practice talk, or at least give the first part of it. Okay. What more about content? We've got the start of the talk. It's important to have an appropriate introduction and to know your audience.
Well, the fine terms of what jargon is.
Okay, so omit jargon, really, right? And that may take a lot of practice because it's just so insidious how it creeps into our language. Yeah. What was it that you had just said? Do this make it interesting?
It can be fascinating to you, but is it really of interest to a broader audience?
Okay. So in other words, project your, don't just have in mind the audience when you write your talk and what would appeal, what about your topic would appeal to your audience.
Yeah, I've heard talks where people are very much inside their own topic because that's where they live in their research. Mm-hmm. And, and it's almost hard for the audience to get into those.
So try to make your topic interesting to the audience. Okay, well now I think there's a decision you have to make early on in preparing, and that is, what is it that you really wanted to convey? And I think that's where a lot of people go wrong, is that they think that they need to explain every step in detail. But if you're, especially for a general audience, what they're going to go away with is an overall flavor. First, they're going to go away thinking, did I enjoy or did I not enjoy that talk? They're not going to say, oh, well, let's say I learned this and this and this and this. The overall impression, and they might only pick up one or two things. So I think you have to keep in mind your objective. Okay, set your objective, but it has to be just one or two main points. And spell it right. And I think when in doubt, leave it out. You know, if there's some detail, just omit it. Because it's more important to reinforce, repeat your points or bring it, stress it in different ways throughout the talk. What about humor?
Not everybody's up to that.
A little bit is helpful.
It is. The problem is knowing whether that little bit is going to go over or not. And So I guess if you're going to use some humor, you might want to try it out on people first, especially if it's a canned joke.
Humor and humility.
Humor and humility? And how do they go together? Maybe I'll put that way up front. Don't be arrogant. Yeah. Probably especially for scientists, because we've got an image to overcome of being arrogant. It's important to, whatever you say, it's probably important to at least give the audience the idea that you try to communicate with them and that you're a human person.
We call them public lectures, but they're not really lectures, at least not the good ones. They're little storytellers. We used to lecture, and that's not part of the lecture.
I'm just going to put a bit of humor, but carefully. And you're saying, tell a story.
Yeah.
So look at your talk as a story.
There should be a scene setting and a development and a climax.
Yeah.
And the protagonist is usually not a person, it's usually an idea.
Yeah, right. But leave out the details of exact, I think, you know, in terms of how, what, when, where, and how. You know, the why is really important. People want to know why you did something. They want to know what you learned. They don't so much want to know how you did it in gory detail. So it's more important to tell them how it, why you did it and what you learned and what your conclusions are than to get bogged down in this little detail in the middle.
And how it might impact their lives. Why should they care about what you learned?
Yeah. I think that's a tough one for scientists, because not everything impacts their lives, you know.
It doesn't have to be specific. You know, a product will be generated from this idea and do this for you. But I think even a more general idea about why is species important, you know, where the human thinking is taking us.
And that can just be in terms of ideas,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Let me just see if there's anything else that I... Should we talk about visuals? I put view graphs up here, but more and more people use PowerPoint. I don't know if people have any reaction one way or another to talks with PowerPoint, talks with view graphs. Do most of you prefer to see a PowerPoint presentation? Is Sarah? Yeah. Is Sarah shaking her head no?
I think there's bad versions of each.
Mm-hmm. So what's a bad version of a PowerPoint presentation?
No content.
Okay, plus or minus, no content.
The real asset of it is that it can emphasize. Can I just do this?
Sure.
Especially sequentially, it can emphasize different parts of a single visual presentation, whereas with a view graph, either you cover it up, which people hate, or you know, it's all there at once.
Mm-hmm.
With the PowerPoint, you can orchestrate it.
Yeah, I think it's cool.
Less waste.
Less waste of...
Burning out those old transparencies.
Well, that's...
Environmentally.
Yeah, it's environmentally friendly. Yeah.
Disk space.
Well, visually, it's really impressive. I mean, Zoe's from astrophysics, and you just must have, I mean, you must be able to download beautiful things right, left and right.
Animation.
Okay, animation. Yeah.
You think you make a talk that works by downloading that for
you? You had equations on
Phil got sort of fit in his page, did up equations, and that's just useless.
Oh.
And
it's very hard to do that in PowerPoint. You can't. Yeah. It's very hard.
You mean the PowerPoint just fits the equation to the...
Well, it takes a lot of work to make an equation in PowerPoint.
Yeah, I would think so.
Really, it does take work.
So you're saying the equations are easier in view graphs?
There are some...
Which are better for equating them, right? You know them, Paul. There's some which is easier.
Yeah, but it's still hard to do a whole page of equations.
Is that right?
Yeah. No, yeah. But Keynote is very good.
And there are people you can just directly show PDF, so they're really then it's perhaps the ones.
Yes, then.
Yeah. Oh, well, there's a free equation editor on the web. You can download, you can do all the everything on tech, and then you can just drag it into it. Yeah, so that's actually very, you can do a whole page very easily, actually.
Don't need a page of equations.
Yeah, right. Well, actually, that's an advantage not to be able to do too many equations. Okay.
You should stay
in the car. I think there's a lot of other reasons now with regard to view graphs and for the end professional. I mean, probably in anthropology, in many fields, because they're public, and you know, they just get used to PowerPoints. And
of course, to be able to exhibit dynamics, graphical things into motion is impossible in a view graph.
Mm-hmm. Handwriting is another characteristic of view graphs. Sometimes it's just impossible to read something.
And getting self-conscious here. Ben handwriting.
More text than the view graph.
But it's just like,
if they're prepared by hand.
Yeah.
Right.
In a hurry. I think some view graphs are great. Some physicists really are artists for view graph medium. Mike Turner is good for this.
Mm-hmm. In what way? I mean, what aspect of view graphs has he turned to his advantage?
It's hard to describe. It's a little bit artistic that there's a sense of layout in the view graph.
Some people can do that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the colors are nice, and the hand drawn is
A bit of the comic strip.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, sometimes they can be done attitude before your very eyes, which is impossible.
Personal, yeah,
I like the dynamic aspect of it. Because you like to add things. You know, if I were using VGraph right now, it'd be very nice. I'd just be writing comments. It's just sort of the substitute blackboard. I found once for teaching, I actually had written out a whole bunch of VGraphs for a class, and then I put the view graph down, and the kids just started copying. And then they were so busy copying, they weren't listening, and it made me go faster because I wasn't slowed up by writing. And after a few days, a few students said, you know, could you not pre-prepare the view graphs, because it makes you go too fast. So after that, I just planned it in my head, and I would just do the same thing in real time, and that went better. So I think for teaching, which is different from a lecture.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Students in big lecture courses hate PowerPoint. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've actually seen graphs exhibited with no legends.
One of my pet peeves. Okay, so this is sort of the... I mean, everyone has to just decide which way to go. So in terms of properties of view graphs, you're saying you better label everything, right?
Mm-hmm. So I was going to say, maybe we can talk a little bit about the written content of the view graph.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there are rules, for instance, like each view graph ought to make one major point. You might.
No more than one point per group. Mm-hmm. More than one point per view graph. Absolutely. What about too much writing on a view graph? I mean, some people will actually write out their talk on a view graph. And then they're reading it, But the audience is reading it at a different time. And sometimes if they're, it's hard to, I find it hard. If I see a view graph, I want to read it. But then I'm distracted from listening to the speaker. So keywords rather than writing everything out. So, you know, if you want to use your view graph as a prompter or your PowerPoint slide as a prompter, that's okay, but don't write out everything. Okay. Minimize words. But I yeah.
There are people who get information better by listening and people who get it better with their eyes.
Yeah.
And I certainly get better with my eyes. Like, I have a short attention span. So, I mean, I think it's good to try to reach both by having it, if not ever completely written out, at least have the visuals reasonably self-contained.
Yeah. A lot of times I'll write out a phrase for a visual. Usually I can go back and say the same thing like half the number of words. Mm-hmm. So you might try that, just see how few words you can get by with. I think one advantage of having, it's important to have keywords on there. I know there was one speaker I was listening to and there was one word that was really key to everything, it was clear. And I wasn't sure what that word was. But then it appears on a view graph and I said, oh, okay. So include keywords. Especially if it's a jargon phrase, if you've introduced it, but then you're gonna keep on using it. The reader will then know, oh yeah, that's what it is.
There's two schools of thought on PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. One, they tell you to read everything on the slide. So you put it up there and the person reads everything you're reading. I find that very irritating, but then other people, you know, are following along. And so I'm not sure where that falls in terms of delivery.
Yeah, I'm not sure. What people think.
Your audience, if you have a lot of people who don't speak English as a first language, you have to read everything on the slide.
Mm-hmm. Oh, because they're a slower reader.
They're a slower reader, and they may not understand. Mm-hmm. May not understand what you say, so you have to repeat everything. Mm-hmm. Definitely take out a lot of the words and just have keywords, but mm-hmm. I found when I gave a talk to people that, you know, were from all over the place, it had to be much more careful that I repeated things several times visually and audio.
Right. I forgot to say when we talked about labeling everything, one of my pet peeves is people will have a graph and there'll be some crazy curve like this. And it'll say maybe time and distance or whatever. And they'll say, okay, so now as you can see, this moves all over the place. And then it's gone. And then you're saying, what moves all over the place? So I think it's important to say, here is a plot of distance versus time. And if need be, you tell the person how to interpret this kind of graph. Say, you know, when it's going up, that means you're going further away from the origin or whatever you have to say to explain it. But I found all disciplines tend to have their sort of traditional graphs or ways of plotting things. And it becomes second nature to you, like a band structure. You see a band structure and say, oh, well, I know exactly how the material's going to act. Well, a person seeing the band structure for the first time isn't going to know that. So that's really important to me, is to not only label the axes, but when you talk about it, tell what it's plotted against what else, and if need be, why that's an important relationship to show. Okay, color. What about color?
There are good colors and bad colors.
Consistently, okay, use color.
Colors change. So like titles or subtitles or whatever.
I'm right with you, Joey. That's one of my... Yeah, you don't want to, you know, for stress in one view graph red and everything important in the other is blue or... you know, baryons are red in this one, and the baryons are green in the next one. Yeah, be consistent and use it effectively. I mean, they use that information in the color. Just, it's not just there to make it look pretty. It's more importantly, it's a parameter. It's a way to express a quantity, something, some information. You can code it.
Some color schemes are bad. Red text on blue background.
Yeah.
Are better
than
yeah.
And some people don't seem to realize that.
Okay.
I think for PowerPoint, a dark background with light lettering works best. Yeah.
Also, some of the designs are so creative. You can get in the way of seeing what you're trying to make.
By the way, some people are colorblind, although more limited than women.
That's true. And they're most often red, green, colorblind. So don't use red and green in a plot.
Mean two different
things, unless you also have dashes. Backgrounds can be a problem. PowerPoint encourages you to use backgrounds. People will slap in a picture of their university taken from the air or something. It makes it hard to read their words.
Right.
Oh, right, right. Don't use busy backgrounds. I don't think that picture of the university belongs in the talk anyway. Unless they're showing the site of the new accelerator.
There's some of those patterns that PowerPoint wants you to use. Those are bad.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else about? Okay. Well, I had some to show here.
Samples have to be big enough for people to see through.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get things that are infinitesimal in size.
Okay, so label everything, make it readable. So sometimes it's if you're, especially when you're in a big lecture hall, are you tall enough? Thanks. It's good to stand back to, let's see. Oh, here we go. I think this is supposed to do it. Okay. Okay, so I have some examples. All of these examples were taken from PowerPoint presentations that were parts of public lectures given to the community here at ITP. We have evening public lecture series. The speakers are usually carefully chosen to be good ones, and they're very popular with the community. The first few examples are examples of how you can use visuals to bring in some interest for a public audience. This is an historical note. This is one case where I think it was very important for the presenter to read the text because it's small, so it's not necessarily visual, and it's long. So I don't know if you want me to read it, but essentially this is a very prescient guy who essentially predicted that there would be more planets in the solar system like our own, even when the church fathers are saying that wouldn't. He says the countless worlds in the universe are no worse and no less inhabited than our Earth. Okay.
And you've heard him at the stage.
I think the public likes to see real phenomena. This is not a particularly, this didn't project too well here. I think it came across better in the original. But this is one of these images taken with the scanning tunneling microscope. And of course, we all know they can present some beautiful images. Actually, I'm looking at my computer screen and it's a lot lighter. It just came out dark in this. Maybe it's just dark in this. So I think it's just much darker there. And of course, astronomers have a lot of material that, you know, everyone loves to see these pictures. But this one I thought was especially effective because it was a good way for the public to appreciate that you see different things in different wavelengths. So this is the visible. Now here's some wording that's not very big. And if you see that there's something in your view graph that's not very big, you may want to repeat it. So in the visible, in the infrared, and a hydrogen light filter. So you see more, you get sharper resolution at that final wavelength. I think that it's important for the people to see real physics equipment, real world. I had one student when I was teaching at Rutgers. That student had a tour of a high energy lab there. It was actually a nuclear lab. And that, in particular, the student had gone to the room where the detectors were. And he came back and said, it was a mess. There were wires and junk all over the place, you know. You see, in physics textbooks, you see these clean, sterile diagrams of how the equipment's arranged. But, you know, it's good to see, you know, why things like little wires coming out here and soldered. And also, here's another kind of lab. You know, it sort of makes it more real for people to see where it is that physicists work, what are the conditions in which they work. You know, they go down in these mines and spend lots of time in just sort of dirty old tunnels. But good physics is done there.
By the way, that's an example of a bad background, yes. In my opinion. On this slide, it doesn't make very much difference.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay. Oh, wait, oh, I wanted to. Wait. I'm going to come back to that. Does anyone have a stopwatch? Okay, I'm going to give you 75 seconds. Oh, how do I go backwards on this?
Just take
the back out. Oh, okay. I need to put on my glasses. Oh, here. Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, the speaker, as I recall on this one, was not talking about, there's not reading the words. So he was going on like I am and talking about something. But wasn't the words up there? But even if we did, our planetary systems like our own, what is the distribution of planetary mass? Only astronomy measures the planet mass is ambiguous.
Astrometry,
right? Yes. Are there low mass planets in the inhabitable zone? Okay. But actually, it's a fair, I took the total number of slides that this fellow presented divided by the length of his talk. Actually, I gave him an hour, but that was not, it's probably a shorter time than that because he had time for questions. But at the very least, each one of those points, four ones, should be at least one other view graph, right?
Yeah, everybody would have read astrometry.
Oh, you think so?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because it's very, you're like, whoa. And so you're trying to read it really fast, right?
Yeah.
The first time I read it, mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense. And nobody's going to know what that means.
No one would know. I mean, you could have a view graph entitled astronomy. I can't say it. Astrometry. And then what... You know, the average reader's not going to know what LY is.
Or FGK.
You know, it's tempting when you know a lot to get a lot of it in, to, you know, I'll just stick this in front of them. But how much can you absorb in less than a minute? And that's typically the amount of time you have for each few graphs.
That was a slide that he prepared for his NASA friends, and then it accidentally found its way in the photo.
I would say even for NASA friends, they don't want to see that.
It's really bearable in that context. You know, but people who all are really familiar with yeah.
It reminds me of being, it seems like if they say, well, you can only have 10 view graphs. Yeah. That's the kind of view graph I might expect everyone to come with. This is from the same talk, and I think it's the same problem. First of all, he had a problem here where the background interferes with the letter, so you can't read it real well.
It's very easily.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's not hard to fix that. Right. Star formation theory, can't Laplace. It's a public audience. I was there at this talk. He did not talk about what Kant Laplace was. Okay, so he could get rid of that. Based on modern observations, Plaver's existence of, and then these are the theories of star formation, which he quickly tried to tell us about. And he says, well, you see, in this one, da 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 da, and in this one, that's about how much time we had. So, it's just overload, and this was in the evening. Okay, this was my favorite of the public lectures, Boris Kaiser on neutrinos.
That's a picture,
yeah. And I thought this was very nice because it's trying to say, you know, we've got neutrinos coming through us every day, and people in your audience are going to identify with that person there getting zapped by these neutrinos from the sun. And it's,
I think Doug's comment about the background holds here. It's distracting.
Well, that's true. The beauty of this view graph is its simplicity. You know, it just really makes the point very visually. I love the writing out of this big number. And Joe did something very similar with 32 zeros the other night. And neutrino, lots of them get under your skin. And that was the title of the talk. Neutrinos get under your skin. So, I put this one in to show you effective use of color. Because this person, now I don't know about the blue and the purple. But this and the background does interfere with the color that he chose. But throughout the talk, Kaiser used yellow for electron neutrinos, red for muon neutrinos, and green for tau neutrinos. And he used the color, the blue, half or more of the expected electron neutrinos to arrive for every day from the sun are missing. And I guess he wanted the purple to distinguish the concluding question. But I don't know whether that's too much or too little color or not. But
one other nice thing about this, he speaks in complete sentences.
Yes.
And you know, there are arguments for or against that, but it seems to me he's doing it in a good way. Too many PowerPoint slides are just broken phrases.
Mm-hmm. So even I had suggested using more bullet, short phrase items. You think this is better to use the complete sentence?
I think this is a good example of speaking of complete sentence.
Mm-hmm. I like to use gazillions for the general audience because they don't care exactly what number. They're not going to go home saying it's 10 to the 8th or 10 to the 12th. But gazillions, they'll remember that. This is just to show you then in a subsequent slide, the same color scheme held for electron, muon, and tau neutrinos. And the sun, you know, blue is a good choice for the Earth because we always see those satellite pictures of the blue Earth. And sun, yellow, you know, think about the colors that people will have a natural association with anyway.
He's got a good sense of simple illustration of essential points, too.
I mean,
one could make that picture a lot busier and detract from it.
And it visually says, you know, you can have electrons coming out of the core and muon and tau neutrinos coming out of the sun, and likening it to clear glass. this doesn't stop the light, or the glass wouldn't stop either light or this neutrinos, but it does increase the number of neutrinos that change the flavor. So it makes the point very, very well. This was just masterful talk. I just had a big smile on my face the whole time, because he wasn't telling me a whole lot that I didn't know, but it was such a pleasure to hear it told nicely. And you have to remember that about your, even if you're talking to physicists. Physicists don't care if you tell them things that you already know, if you're telling them in a way that's nice and clear and simple, I think they get pleasure out of hearing it. This is a little bit busy, but this is a talk on scanning tunneling microscopes and moving atoms around on surfaces. And this wasn't the first, this person started out by just introducing purple atoms on the surface and the tip of the STM with the gold. So then he came along and in subsequent slides showed the additional complications, the tunneling current and the circuit, ways that you measure the Z distance and the X distance or control it, and measuring the current that goes to a monitor. So I think it's this is an effective use of my mind of a simple diagram to show people what the atomic picture is looking like. I don't know. Do you think it's too busy?
Yeah. Not if it's built up, not if it's on the screen for long enough.
But sure, it emphasizes the point that this tip, this sharply pointed tip, comes down to being just one atom at the very bottom. And you are measuring, in fact, at that atomic level. And then this is another one from the same show, from the same from the same talk, showing the two modes in which you can operate in STM. And again, I thought it was nicely done. That if you have an atom on the surface, you can have it either imaging mode, in which case your tip moves up and then back down, it's going over this hump, or else you can actually go down and pick up that extra atom.
By the way, if you want to put in the effort, you can make that animated. That would be good.
Oh, yeah, that'd be fun. And that's it for that. And let me see if I can make this disappear. Yes. Oof. This is my first PowerPoint. I figured I could do a cut and paste PowerPoint okay.
You know, I think Boris told me that was his first PowerPoint.
Oh, you're kidding.
I think it was him.
Oh, yeah. Well, he did it. He must have put a lot of work into it because he had those little stick, you know, those figures. Okay. Talk, visuals, preparation, fielding questions. Just a few rules. What advice about fielding questions?
Before we get to that, there's one general point that sort of fits everything together. That's how many slides do you show? You could have a rule of thumb about that.
Right.
For me, I try not to show more than 20 slides in an hour, for instance. But different people have different rules of thumb.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, going through this, the slides that were given for these public lectures, ITP, there were quite a few talks that were 30 slides, and I thought that was a lot, because that's one every 2 minutes. If your talk is an hour, but the talk should only go 45 minutes. So you certainly don't want to have less than 1 minute per slide, and it's better if you can have 2 minutes per slide, because it's just too dizzying. So.
I was at a 58 in one of these. I was noticing that. It was at page 58. Was that really, did he really have that
It didn't, I was at that talk and it just didn't seem, it seemed like it was just very well paced.
PowerPoints, they seem to go faster than transparency. So these, it depends on how people use them, but more slides for talk. Mm-hmm. And experimentalists go through many more slides because they'll show data I mean, if you have visuals that you're just look at this and go on, you can really turn through a very large number of slides.
Yeah, but if you...
Scientific talk with the real content on each slide, it's, you know, 3 minutes each.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So probably 20 slides probably is a good number. And if you go over that, justify it to yourself. So that's roughly 2 minutes per slide. That's a good guideline. Okay, question and answer sessions. Yes?
Yeah, I think you have to respect your audience and thank them for their questions, because especially in this venue, it's a very, you feel that either everybody else in the audience got it and they didn't, or, you know, so they're asking stupid questions, and I think it's pretty helpful to thank people and make them feel that their contributions.
So no question is a dumb question. Yeah, that's a good attitude to have. Good.
Something I think I should do more is repeat questions when we're asked.
As an audience member, I really appreciate it when the question is repeated. Especially if that person is in the front row, then nobody else hears that question. Because very often it may be the question half the audience has, and they want to know the answer.
Sometimes it even helps us not only repeat it but explain, or rephrase.
Oh, right. Repeat. Okay, rephrase if necessary, or sometimes clarify. Sometimes you say, "You mean, are you asking this?" To make sure you understand what they want in their question.
Try to keep the answers short.
Mm-hmm.
I think that helps a lot.
Yeah, tell Condoleezza Rice that.
Okay, so it would have helped if she answered the question for that.
So, yeah, you don't want to take up time. You can answer more questions and keep it short and focused and as much to the point as possible.
You have to think ahead of time about how long you might have a Q&A period, so you can either get help from the moderator, get you off, you know, it's going on and on.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Limit.
Or do that yourself.
Okay, so limit Q&A maybe by prior arrangement with the moderator. A good moderator will usually do that. What about the question you don't know the answer to?
Oh, tell the audience they don't know the answer to it.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
We're back to don't be arrogant.
But I have a question. What happens, especially like colloquial, when you get somebody in the audience, you know, it's open to the public or something, or
Yeah.
And generally what they do is they try really hard not to, if he tries to ask a question, the moderator actually doesn't allow him to.
Yeah.
But, I mean, does anybody have any other way of doing that?
any suggestions?
It's a little desperate.
What?
Well, you can change it, right?
You what?
When you repeat the question, you can change it.
It would be something interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one strategy.
Some of the longer questions, you know, for more complicated questions, I'd be happier to talk to people afterwards.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's a good point. That's
Maybe about 3 or 4 different little trim away techniques.
Yeah. Yeah, I think answering it in a very short way, and then the person comes back with a but,
yeah,
then you say, well, let's talk about it afterwards. Yeah. You do your audience a favor that way. Just keep that in mind. Not everyone wants to hear your answer to that weird question. Yeah. And there's some topics that will draw these questions more than others.
It doesn't belong on your list, but I have to say I'm always amazed by Martin Rees, who has a good answer for every question. But not only that, he actually has a view graph.
Oh,
yeah. I tried to ask him questions, but he didn't have view graphs for him.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, it's not a bad strategy to anticipate questions. Okay. What about the person who gives you a hard time?
Humor.
Humor?
Humor should come into it.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit of humor. Be very careful with that.
Yes.
Yeah. I think.
You don't want to ridicule anybody.
Yeah.
No, not ridicule, but.
Yeah.
You
have to be careful.
So you respect their point of view.
Oh, if they're saying I disagree with you, yeah. I think sometimes it's best just to say, well, let's talk about that afterwards. It's sort of like, let's go outside. by the way, let's see, are there other? Yeah, I meant to ask you in terms of anticipating questions. I came across something in a book about giving talks that I thought was really good. And it says, when you plan your talk, anticipate the questions your audience might have. And here are the kinds of questions the audience might have. Ho-hum. In other words, you better tell him why he should be interested. Why bring that up? For instance, so what? I mean, if you have in mind that this really negative guy sitting in your audience and he's saying these things to you, it might challenge you to answer these questions. I added to that list, my favorite is, huh? So, just a few words about jitters, nervousness. Does anyone have any strategies for dealing with it?
A little stage fright is a normal reaction.
Okay.
Before getting a talk.
Practice. If you actually read it out loud once, it really does help.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Practice. Stage fright. Okay, the other, you said it's okay. Yeah. But practice is good. I personally try to have in mind really strongly what are the first few, you don't want to memorize a talk, but I like to go in memorizing maybe the first three sentences. That really gets me off on a good foot. If I have a good strong opening and I come in and I know exactly what it's going to say, then I'm off. Okay, so. Does anyone ever write out the talk just before you? You do? Yeah, so, and it probably doesn't, does it end up being much like what you end up saying? Or does it just help focus?
What I say.
The what?
So the first slide, the introduction.
Yeah.
But then, I don't really know.
Uh-huh. But just to get you, just to sort of work your way through.
Then like I don't know if I've said everything. I don't know if I've gone through everything that I need to actually go through.
Yeah.
It's much easier if I write it down.
Right.
Some people are different.
Yeah.
And they just need to, and if they say it, it works.
Yeah. Any other coping strategies? Yeah. Well. Yeah.
Some things I wanted to add to this. From the point of view of giving a talk in public or somewhere, perhaps not just here, although it's pertinent here, mm-hmm. but also in town or to a group you may be speaking to in Santa Barbara that's interested, that as you come in, it's helpful as the audience gathers, it's helpful to have a display up there already that has your name and your affiliation and maybe the title of your talk, because not everybody brings in the thing, the invitation you've mailed or remembers what the title was, and it tells people to talk when they come in. It's a very simple graphic. It helps to have handouts for people who really are interested in what you said afterwards, simply either a list of suggested public reading, publicly accessible readings, so people can go away and find out a bit more about what you talked about. It really adds some depth. They can pick it up on the way out. It just adds a context to what you've done and seems like you've thought about their interests. Or any press releases on what's happened recently in that area, so they can understand the recent developments and why it might be of interest. I think a title is really important. I mean, it doesn't have to be Comedy Central, but it needs to be something that people will say, it doesn't put them off, it doesn't sound too dense, where they think, well, it's obviously not for me. But it doesn't have to be the other end of the scale either, so that's, some care needs to be put into that.
And it's probably better to err on the side of light than on, even if it doesn't exactly say what you're going to talk about.
And just the other thing is the temperature of the room and the airflow. I don't know if you can ask people you're talking to about that. The whole audience can go to sleep. If the air doesn't flow in here, I've seen people going to sleep when they didn't mean to, just because it gets too warm. It sounds tickying, but it helps to talk to people about the room ahead of time and just make sure that people are comfortable.
That's good. I should have introduced Sarah. Sarah Vaughn is the development director here at KITB and a scientist by training, but she certainly has to deal with a lot of the consequences of our inability or our ability to communicate. A lot of successes. If we do it right, we make her job easier, right? Okay. Well, now I just did. The final thing is about ending. You're not supposed to say, well, that's all. But that's what I'm going to say.
Okay. You could also announce cookies.
Oh, yeah, cookies. Oh, I forgot. Cookies.